Chapter 5 In Lower Egypt. I am going on a journey, Ameres said to his son a few days after the return from the farm. I shall take you with me, Khebron, for I am going to view the progress of a fresh canal that is being made on our estate in Goshen. I have already taught you the theory of the work. It is well that you should gain some practical experience in it. There is no more useful or honorable profession than that of carrying out works by which the floods of the Nile are conveyed to the thirsty soil. Thank you, father. I should like it greatly, Khebron replied. And may Amuba go with us? Yes, I was thinking of taking him. Jethro can also go, for I take a retinue with me. I would far rather travel without this state and ceremony. But as a functionary of state I must conform to the customs. And indeed, even in Goshen, it is as well always to travel in some sort of state, and the people there are of a different race to ourselves.
I have heard of them, father. They belong to the same race as the shepherd kings who were such bitter tyrants to Egypt. How is it that they stayed behind when the shepherds were driven out?
They are of the same race, but they came not with them, and formed no part of their conquering armies. The shepherds, who came from the land lying to the east of the great sea, had reigned here for a long time when this people came. They were relations of that Joseph who, as you have read in your history, was chief minister of Egypt. He came here as a slave, and was certainly brought from the country whence our oppressors came. But they say that he was not of their race, but that his forefathers had come into the land from a country lying far to the east. He gained the confidence of the king, became his minister, and ruled wisely as far as the king was concerned. At any rate, this Joseph brought his family out of the land at the east of the great sea, and land was given to them in Goshen, and they settled there, and flourished, and multiplied greatly. They were held in favor as long as the shepherd kings ruled over us. But when Egypt rose and drove the shepherds and their followers out of the land, this people remained behind, and they have been naturally viewed with suspicion by us. Although the power of the people eastward of the great sea has now been completely broken, Joseph's people are still viewed unfavorably. Prejudices take long to die out, Khebron. And the manner in which these people cling together, marrying only among themselves and keeping themselves apart from us, gives a certain foundation for the dislike which exists. Personally, I think the feeling is unfounded. They are industrious and hard-working, though they are somewhat disposed to resist our authority. For a long time after their settlement, they worshipped their own god, but many have long adopted our religion.
"Surely that must be wrong," Khebron said. "Each nation has its gods, and if a people forsake their own gods, it is not likely that other gods would care for them as they do for their own people."
"It is a difficult question, Khebron, and one which it is best for you to leave alone at present. You will soon enter into the lower grade of the priesthood, and you will learn enough to enlighten you to some extent."
Khebron was too well trained to ask further questions, but he renewed the subject with Amuba as they strolled in the garden together afterwards. I wonder how each nation found out who were the gods who specially cared for them, Amuba.
I have no idea, Amuba replied. I was not long ago asking Jethro nearly the same questions, but he could give me no answer.
Why do you not ask your father?
I have asked my father, but he will not answer me.
On the following day the high priest and his party started for Goshen. The first portion of the journey was undertaken by water. The craft was a large one, with a pavilion of carved wood on deck, and two masts with great sails of many colors cunningly worked together. As they floated down the river, he explained to his son the various objects which they passed. And he gave him the history of the various temples, towns, and villages, named the many waterfowl basking on the surface of the river, and told him of their habits. He also pointed out the great tombs to him, and told him by whom they were built.
I long to see the pyramids, Khebron said. Are they built of brick or stone? I've been told that their surface is so smooth and shiny they look as if cut from a single piece.
They are built of vast blocks of stone, each of which employed the labor of many hundreds of men to transport from the quarries where they were cut.
Were they the work of slaves or of the people at large?
Vast numbers of slaves labored at them, the priest replied. But numerous as these were, they were wholly insufficient for the work, and well nigh half the people of Egypt were forced to leave their homes to labor at them. What might not have been done with the same labor usefully employed? There, do you see that temple standing on the right bank of the river? That is where we stop for the night.
As they approached the temple, they saw a number of people gathered on the great stone steps reaching down to the water's edge, and strains of music were heard. On landing, Ameres was greeted by the priests, and as soon as he entered the temple, a procession was formed. Priests bearing sacred vessels and the symbols of the gods walked before him to the altar. A band of unseen musicians struck up a processional air. Priestesses and maidens, also carrying offerings and emblems, followed Ameres. After the ceremonies were concluded, the procession moved in order as far as the house of the chief priest. Here a banquet was already in readiness. To this Ameres sat down with the principal priests, while Kebron was conducted to the apartment prepared for him, where food from the high table was served to him. Amuba and the rest of the suite of the high priest were served in another apartment. As soon as Kebron had finished, he joined Amuba.
"Let us slip away," he said. "The feasting will go on for hours, and then there will be music far on into the night. My father will be heartily tired of it all. When we reach Goshen, we shall live in a little house which my father has had constructed, and where we shall have no more fuss and ceremony than we do at our own farm. Then he will be occupied with the affairs of the estates and in the works of irrigation. And although we shall be with him when he journeys about, I expect we shall have plenty of time for amusement and sport."
For a week the journey down the river continued. Then they arrived at Memphis, where they remained for some days. Ameres passed the time in ceremonial visits and by taking part in the sacrifices in the temple. Kebron and Amuba visited all the temples and public buildings, and one day, attended by Jethro, went out to inspect the great pyramids.
"This surpasses anything I have seen," Jethro said as they stood at the foot of the great pyramid of Cheops. "What a wonderful structure!"
"It is marvelous indeed," Amuba said. "What wealth and power a monarch must have had to raise it! How could this king have exacted such terrible toil and labor from his subjects as this must have cost?"
Kebron replied, "There are some kings so powerful and haughty that they tyrannize over the people. Cheops was one of them, but he was not allowed to be buried in the great tomb that he had built for himself. I know not where his remains rest, but this huge pyramid stands as an eternal monument of the failure of human ambition, the greatest and costliest tomb in all the world, but without an occupant, save that of one of his queens."
On leaving Memphis, one more day's journey was made by water, and the next morning the party started by land. Ameres rode in a chariot, and Amuba and Kebron traveled in a wagon drawn by two oxen. The rest of the party went on foot. At the end of 2 days they arrived at their destination. The house was a small one compared to the great mansion near Thebes, but it was built on a similar plan.
"I shall be busy for some days," Ameres said to Kebron on the evening of their arrival. "And it will therefore be a good opportunity for you to see something of the various branches of sport that are to be enjoyed in this part of Egypt. The steward will place men at your disposal, and you can take with you Amuba and Jethro."
In the morning Kebron had an interview with the steward, who told him that he had arranged the plan for an expedition.
"You will find little about here, my lord," he said. "But a day's journey to the north you will be near the margin of the lake, and there you will get sport of all kinds, and can at your will fish in its waters, snare waterfowl, hunt the great river horse in the swamps, or chase the hyena in the low bushes on the sand hills. I have ordered one of my chief men to accompany you. He will see that when you arrive you obtain men skilled in the sports and acquainted with the locality and the habits of the wild creatures there."
An hour later some 20 slaves drew up before the house, carrying on their heads provisions, tents, and other necessities. A horse was provided for Kebron, but he decided that he would walk with Amuba. "There is no advantage in going on a horse," he said, "when you have to move at the pace of footmen, and possibly we may find something to shoot on the way." The leader of the party told them that doubtless when they left the cultivated country, which extended but a few miles further north, game would be found. 6 dogs accompanied them. 4 of them were powerful animals, kept for the chase of the more formidable beasts, the hyena or lion. The other 2 were much more lightly built, and were capable of running down a deer. The season was the cold one, and the heat was so much less than they were accustomed to at Thebes that the walk was a pleasant one. Kebron and Amuba, carrying their bows, walked along chatting gaily at the head of the party. Jethro and Rabah, the foreman, came next. Then followed 2 slaves leading the dogs in leashes, ready to be slipped at a moment's notice, while the carriers followed in the rear. Occasionally they passed through scattered villages, where the women came to their doors to look at the strangers, and where generally offerings of milk and fruit were made to them. The men, for the most part, were at work in the fields.
"They are a stout-looking race," Kebron remarked to the leader of the party. "They are stubborn to deal with," Rabah replied. "It is easier to manage 1,000 Egyptian peasants than 100 of these Israelites. But indeed, they are hardly treated fairly, and have suffered much. Many burdens have been laid upon them. They have had to give far more than their fair share of labor towards the public works, the making of bricks, and the erection of royal tombs and pyramids. It is strange that they do not shave their heads as do our people," Kebron said.
"But I do not," Amuba laughed, "nor Jethro. Still, I do think that these Israelites wear their hair inconveniently long. And yet the long plaits that their women wear down their back are certainly graceful, and the women themselves are fair and comely."
Kebron shook his head.
"They may be fair, Amuba, but I should think that they would make very troublesome wives. They lack altogether the subdued and submissive look of our women. I would rather hunt a lion than have the women of one of these villages set upon me."
In a few miles cultivation became more rare. Sandhills took the place of the level fields, and only here and there in the hollows were patches of cultivated ground. A few minutes later a deer started from a clump of bushes. The dogs were instantly let slip and started in pursuit. Rabah exclaimed to Kebron,
"Hurry on 100 yards, my lord, and take your position on that mound. The dogs know their duty, and you will see they will presently drive the stag within shot."
Kebron called Amuba to follow him, and ran forward. By the time they reached the mound, the stag was far away, with the dogs laboring in pursuit. All were soon hidden from sight among the sand hills, and the lads had doubts whether the dogs would ever drive their quarry back to the spot where they were standing. It was full 1/4 hour before pursuers and pursued came in sight again. The pace had greatly fallen off, for one of the dogs was some 20 yards behind the stag. The other was out on its flank at about the same distance away, and was evidently aiding in turning it towards the spot where the boys were standing.
"We will shoot together," Kebron said. "It will come within 50 yards of us."
They waited until the stag was abreast of them. The dog on its flank had now fallen back to the side of his companion, as if to leave the stag clear for the arrows of the hunters. The lads fired together just as the stag was abreast, but both arrows flew behind it. They uttered exclamations of disappointment, but before the deer had run 20 yards it gave a sudden leap into the air and fell over. Jethro had crept up and taken his post behind some bushes, in readiness to shoot should the others miss, and his arrow had brought the stag to the ground.
"Well done, Jethro," Amuba shouted.
It was of a species smaller than those to which the deer of Europe belong, with 2 long straight horns.
It will make a useful addition to our fare tonight, Rabah said.
After walking some 15 miles, the lads stopped suddenly on the brow of a sandhill. In front of them was a wide expanse of water, bordered by a band of vegetation. Long rushes and aquatic plants formed a band by the water's edge, while here and there huts with patches of cultivated ground dotted the country.
We are at the end of our journey, Rabah said. These huts are chiefly inhabited by fowlers and fishermen. We will camp at the foot of this mound. The best hunting ground lies a few miles to our left. There we may expect to find game of all kinds in abundance.